Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell and I'm sitting here with Tim Remington, who's very excited because we're sitting across from Rick and John Brewster from the Angels. And they're here because, and one of these things with being in books is you do get to meet some extraordinary people. And we're here because there's a book that's just come out called The Angels, and you guys are going to be supporting it. And it is quite an in-depth look into the whole long career of the Angels.
Yes, it's certainly a long career. It started a band in 74, but we actually had a band before that called the Moonshine Jug and String Band, and that's how the whole thing began. And it's a band that Rick and I started back in 1970. Doc Neeson joined a year later, and the whole thing's just been an evolution, still is really, you know. The band continues to evolve, and some people have come and gone, and we've lost a couple of people, you know, have died, Chris Bailey and Doc Neeson, of course. But the journey continues.
So that original band, I've got this weird image of what kind of band that is.
Moonshine.
And it's completely different to the Angels, the impression
totally
I had of the Angels.
Different.
Could not be more different.
There's actually a photograph in the book, which is...
Yeah, I mean, how it became the Angels is...
It blows my mind.
Well,
it's like going from belly dancing to classical ballet.
Yeah.
But... you know, the thing is also how the Moonshine Jug and String Band happened, which was really just a thing we wanted to do for fun on weekends. And, there's a photo.
I'm just pointing to a photo on the book.
But the thing is about Moonshine is Rick was actually a fantastic, if I may say so, he probably hates me saying it, but he's a great, fantastic classical pianist and was doing really well and possibly would have ended up with a career at... you know, it might have been a concert pianist, who knows, but my friend Pete Thorpe and I started this band and asked Rick if he wanted to come on board, and there was the role that Rick fell into beautifully was to play the washboard with thimbles on his fingers.
Classical?
Electric,
was that,
of course.
Was that classical washboard?
it was just such a great fun thing to do, you know.
And then when you switched over, like, it was like... the way I would see it is like the moment when Bob Dylan put down the acoustic guitar, pick up the electric guitar, and the audience would go, what the hell happened to these guys? Like, you guys didn't even, like, did you have much experience with electric guitars, electric
no,
music?
No, none.
Virtually none. Virtually none. But, basically, it sort of started, I reckon two things that happened. One is we did a gig at the Maiponga Pop Festival, which is a legendary festival, actually predated Sunbury. And it was incredible. Black Sabbath were the headline of that festival, and that's 1970. Music was all around us, and we loved doing the jug band, and no one had any money, so, you know, you bought a set of thimbles for about $5, and, you know, I think the most expensive thing we had in the jug band was my banjo, which I think, from memory, cost $80. And anyway, the whole thing was great, but we were also around all this wonderful music, and we played this Maiponga Pop Festival, and the band that played after us was Daddy Cool. And I remember just looking at Daddy Cool and going, oh, I want to do what they're doing.
Right.
So that might have had some influence on why it changed into an electric band. But the other thing is we recorded a song called Keep You On The Move, which was really a rock song recorded by a jug band. And then we kind of realised that if we wanted to be serious songwriters, that we actually couldn't use the jug band as a vehicle because the music was based around the 1920s. Old blues music and jazz music from the 20s, and you know, we were doing those songs, and it wasn't really an original thing going on, but we wanted to sort of develop as songwriters, so hence that whole process. And we learned to play electric guitars by playing songs from the 50s.
So it wasn't to get chicks. My thought was to get chicks.
Of course.
And free beer.
Yeah, free beer and chicks. And to live the rock and roll
isn't
lifestyle.
Isn't that a common theme for every rock band?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was just waiting for that. After all that, it was just to get some more chicks.
And to avoid a real job.
Yeah.
avoiding a real job that possibly there might have been some illicit substances involved. Free beers, of course.
Yeah.
Fun. And in an environment where music was such a huge part of what was going on around the place, you know. in Adelaide in particular, actually. You know, Adelaide was an incredible place to grow up as a young person because there were wonderful bands playing all over the place, clubs everywhere. You could walk around the city on a Saturday night and, you know, every couple of hundred metres there was a club, you know, and you go downstairs, these little basement venues, and see wonderful bands playing. So it was all around us.
Mm.
And I think it's one of the reasons why so many successful bands came out of Adelaide.
Yeah, I was just looking at the number of them. I was just, it's amazing. I mean, so many of the great bands just...
AC/DC.
Well, Bon Scott was in Adelaide, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he was singing for Fraternity at the time, and they were amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Glenn Shorrock and, you know, of course, Martin's Apprentices were Adelaide band.
Cold Chisel,
of course.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Swanee.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. I mean, we had a busy surfing, I suppose, in Sydney. I don't want to put any competition there, but surely...
And Rick, you mentioned in the book there's a moment where you're in Adelaide, you're living in a nice big house and, you know, picket fence and whatnot, and you come to Sydney, and I think the thing that stood out was the word cockroach house.
Oh, yeah. Wallaringa Mansions.
It was about the cheapest accommodation we could get because, you know, Sydney blew us away how more expensive it was here. So we used to stay at this place, Wallaringa Mansions. We renamed it. I think Doc actually did it. I'm not sure. It might have been you, Rick.
And who was living in the house?
It was a guest house. It was like people everywhere. It was like a rabbit warren.
Yeah, like a boarding house. You know, four or six beds in a room, and you know, communal kitchen and bathroom. The kitchen you couldn't see for the fat covering everything.
Black windows. It was revolting. But there was a bed, and we'd do a 5-hour stint at Checkers on a Monday night, and we'd get $100. And that $100 paid for our accommodation for the week at Cockroach Castle.
And Checkers, of course, was a club down towards Central Station in Sydney. And the likes of Frank Sinatra played at Checkers, I believe.
Shirley Bassey.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a very classy club, but it was not classy by the time we got there.
cheap food and squishy carpet.
One step up from Cockroach Castle. But it was fantastic, and we have wonderful memories of it.
Yeah. Who was the guy? Casey?
Casey was around? I think he was the mayor of Blacktown or somewhere like that. And he ran Checkers, and he was a great guy. And of course, that's the venue that we were playing when George Young, Harry Vander, Angus, and Malcolm Young, and Bon Scott, they all came down to see us play there. And we went to the studios the next day and sang a few of our songs just with acoustic guitars. And I reckon a week later, we were signed up to Albert's and joined that wonderful stable. You know, you think who was there, you know, Ted Mulry Gang, Rose Tattoo, John Paul Young, of course Harry and George doing what the wonderful things that they were doing, Stevie Wright, of course, too, and AC/DC and us.
There's a photo in the book of George Young and Harry Vander sitting around a table having dinner with
you. Yeah, they took us to dinner that night, and I think my caption is, wow, we had the team and we let it go, which is sadly what happened, you know. Yeah. We had, when we were offered a contract in the US with Epic, our manager at the time, in his wisdom, in hindsight, he would probably say it wasn't wisdom, but who knows, pulled us out of that record company. We left Albert's, and I think it was a huge mistake.
What year was that?
The end of 1979.
Mm.
So did you have a sliding scale of success? Like when you were in Adelaide, you're going, we're doing pretty well. And then you moved to Sydney, then you reached a certain point, we're doing pretty well now. And like, did it continue changing? Like your idea of what you guys wanted to achieve as a band or what you thought what success was, did you look at other bands and go, yeah, we should really be doing that sort of stuff?
We did. I guess we went from local success in Adelaide because the joke band, we had a dedicated following, didn't matter where we played, it was packed. And it was great fun and very exciting. And we went from there to trying to do the whole country. And I guess the success level went way down at first.
Yeah.
It took a few years, didn't it, to build that
About
up?
4.5 years before the band really hit the big time.
Is that the time that you guys came together as a unit? Like a lot of bands talk about those kind of years as the trialing years and also the perfecting of the band.
Yeah, I mean the formative years of the band have to be pretty amazing, really, because you're trying to work out what you're trying to do, There's a little bit in the book there called that Raymond Hawkins wrote called The Tipping Point that is just when you think things couldn't be worse, financially, because we were absolutely strapped for cash, trying to make a career out of it, and it was really difficult, but we had the studio, and Harry and George gave Rick and I the okay to produce the band. Well, they actually asked us to produce the band along with Mark Opitz and threw us in the deep end, and for a while it wasn't looking too good, and then we recorded a song called I Ain't the One, which you played.
Mm.
but that Raymond Hawkins calls it a tipping point, and it was too, because when we recorded that song in the studio, we just went ballistic. We just, we thought we found our sound.
Yeah.
And all that process was just a natural thing, given that you're also influenced by what's going on around you. Sex Pistols, I love the Sex Pistols. And there's a little bit of a tip the hat to the Sex Pistols in that song.
There's a comment you make in the book about the day that you brought Nevermind the Bollocks. And I think you had, you mentioned how the band have got a different look. And so you used that as another tipping point, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, probably, yeah. There was all these things, you were saying how things line up, stars align or whatever expression you used, or, fate comes into things. And, like Raymond Hawkins himself, who became our lighting guy, who was amazing. I mean, he created a look for the band on stage that was incredible, drawing off influences of Expressionism, Bertolt Brecht, and, Doc and I both did drama at Flinders Uni, and Rick was heavily into all of that stuff as well. And all of these things, they come together at the same time as a song like I Ain't the One comes together. That Doc goes back and sees his old drama teacher, and he suggests, why don't you dress up like an aristocrat, with a ascot tie. All these things, they all kind of happened around the same time, and all of a sudden we've got something that people just went, wow, have a look
George
at this.
George Young says, why don't you cut your hair?
So
we cut our hair and we started wearing black.
Yeah.
And I decided to stop moving on stage.
Those kinds of things, are they conscious, or are they happening because of your reactions?
Well, for that, that example, very conscious.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I hated moving on stage. Everyone told me it looked like shit. And
Not that bad.
I just said, okay, I'm not going to move. And
they said the same thing about Doc too, Rick.
And bingo. Comfortable.
They said exactly the
first
same thing
ever.
About Doc.
Brilliant. I'm playing guitar on stage.
Well, you got to
on a washboard, it's a different thing. It's all movement.
Yeah,
has to be. Yeah. Although Rick, you were very deadpan with your face when you played the washboard, like a Buster Keaton character. The arms are going like this, and his face is like that. that's evolution I'm talking about. It happened through comments like George Young saying, mm-hmm. "Why don't you have your hair cut?" Mm-hmm. And then, Rick and I looking a bit too, like the boys next door, so we put the shades on. And so one thing that George Young really imparted to us was the entertainment factor.
Mm-hmm.
And, Angus isn't wearing a schoolboy uniform mm-hmm. for no reason.
Yeah, that's right.
It's sheer entertainment. You're up on a stage there, so, all these things just contributed to, and of course, also the music came together, because I wrote on the one, Rick wrote Take a Long Line a week later, which was our first big hit. And then, Marseille was in the mix, and whole collection of songs, Straight Jacket, this whole collection of songs came together at the one time, and we recorded the Face to Face album, which changed our entire life. I mean, it's a multi-platinum selling record, you know, it's huge, still is. You know. And well, it's 40 years old next year.
And in that same year, we got firstly the Meatloaf tour, which put us on the map, and after that, the David Bowie tour, which was huge.
Massive.
And so we went from being well-known in the suburbs and, well, more inner city to, you know, almost cult band, to suddenly the whole country saw us.
And David Bowie was a fan too.
Mm.
You mentioned that in the book.
Yeah, well, the thing is, David Bowie was incredibly hands-on with everything he did, including choosing the band that was going to play with him.
That's right. So he selected you by hand,
he did,
didn't
he? Yeah. And
he insisted.
And mentioned that the first time we met him. Said, you know, I really like your music, and do you want to have dinner with me and my band tonight? You know, that was the first gig. It was in Adelaide.
I think he said, I want Rick Brewster and whoever he's playing with.
Is that the line? Yes. Do you remember?
Yeah. Is that in the book?
No, we managed to leave.
Yeah, it's here, Rick. Edition two.
Yeah. We managed to edit that bit out, Rick. But no, I mean, he was incredible. I mean, and to stand side of stage night after night watching David Bowie do that incredible show with those wonderful musicians was an amazing experience for us. But the other thing that happened that just blew us away was we, on a night off when we were in Sydney, we lived in Sydney, of course, then, and on one of the nights off for the David Bowie tour, we did the Bondi Lifesaver, and at that stage the band's like the number one band in the country. So I mean, there's 1,800 people in a room that's probably should have 600, so it's like sardines.
Yeah.
And there's what we call a punter barrier between the stage and the audience, and we fired up the first song, crowd going nuts, and in comes the whole Bowie entourage. And stands right underneath the band in that punter barrier, the gap.
Where the photographers...
And they were there for the entire show. And that just blew us away.
Did you have any
nerves? They're world famous musicians, yeah. Standing there digging the angels.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. That was a great, you know... Yeah, there's lots of good memories. You know, we've of course, over the last few years, we've had to reach back and remember stuff, you know.
I was going to ask you about that. That's a big ask for... rock and rollers, like for that many years to be bashing it out. And I assume that there were times when you may not have been completely sober on stage and things, a few things like that. How do you remember all this stuff? Like, do you have to talk to people like journalists who've got records of it, or do people keep diaries?
Everywhere. Bob was very good at,
Bob Yates,
the author. He was very good at sussing out old members of road crews, other journalists, ourselves, and, you know, getting all the memories, which were never the same, and putting them all together and writing what came out best in the mix.
And Bob's a great storyteller too.
Yeah, he's
done a wonderful job. And his own memories, he was around for a lot of it.
He's done a wonderful job, but I think really in the main, I think our memories actually are pretty accurate, and if there are times when, you know, I might have corrected Rick or Rick's corrected me, no, it wasn't quite like that, it was like this. Oh, okay. And then you might have that backed up by somebody like Mark Pope, who was on the road with us as a tour manager, or Raymond Hawkins, who, you know, they go, oh no, actually this is what happened, you know. So I think we've, you know, as much as humanly possible, we've got it pretty much right in the book.
I've been dying to ask about that infamous show at the Sydney Opera House, 1980, New Year's Eve. Take us through how that unfolded. There's a story in the book. It's a great story where you're picked up over near Luna Park and a water taxi takes you across the harbour. You can hear the roar of the crowd, flashlights, ambulances, flying champagne bottles.
Well, it was incredibly exciting for us to be headlining that because it's a culmination. We've signed overseas, which, you know, we're only a few months away from touring America for the first time. America, England, Europe. And we're headlining this, you know, major New Year's Eve event at the Opera House, which was a free-to-get-in thing. And they estimate 100,000 people. And so to us, this was like the most amazingly exciting thing. And we walk into sheer chaos because what had happened is that, you know, they didn't have a security fence between the audience and the stage, so people were getting pushed under the stage, so they were climbing up, and security, overzealous security guards were picking up people, throwing them back into the audience, which, you know, was really dangerous because it was a fair way up. And people started getting upset and they started throwing things, you know, they were getting more and more drunk and whatever, and they started throwing things at security guards. The Lord Mayor was hit by a can, you know, Rolf Harris got hit by a can and came off furious.
Marshall Hines.
Poor old Rolf. what have I said?
And the police disappeared too, I read. The police were, they put on this skeleton crew of security people and police for the night. Because
no one could handle it, I think.
They didn't know who you were. Apparently the booking agent didn't know who the Angels
were.
Well,
it was put on by the council.
Right.
Sydney City Council. And they didn't actually, they just, you know, oh, it's this band playing. And at that stage, we're the, like, seriously number one band in the country, and everything was going berserk, and it just, the whole thing just became a sheer chaos and very confronting situation, because Chris Bailey was hit first by an empty Magnum champagne bottle.
Magnum.
I mean, it's this huge thing. I mean, I actually heard it hit his head over the top of my Marshall, which is a very loud amp. Yeah. We were playing Marseille at the time. And bang, and he went down, and the bass went boof. And then I looked across at Doc at the very moment he was hit in the back of the head. And so all of a sudden, the show's over, folks. And Channel 10 were broadcasting it at the time, and somebody came on and said, oh, well, that's New Year's Eve, you know.
Except for me, I kept playing.
Yeah, Rick kept playing.
Didn't see any of it.
I actually went over to Rick.
One cam came, I saw it coming, and I just did. Just moved my head 3 inches.
Yeah, it's actually on the video because it was all filmed.
Yeah,
it's actually on the film. You can see Rick go like that, and the thing goes past him. But it was a. I mean, I in a way, I think that had that not happened, the whole thing might have gone full on into a riot, and people would have been killed because it was just so dangerous. It was very badly set up, but that was hilarious. I mean. Hilarious in retrospect. Chris Bailey's carried off unconscious, blood pouring down his head. Doc Neeson's done this, I think, a little bit of
theatre.
A little bit of theatre involved.
Where the cameras are rolling.
I don't think he was hurt as much as people think, but he did the great swan dive, bang, on the stage. And it was very dramatic, and he's carted off, and you know, Buzz leaves the band, leaves the stage, and I'm about to do the same, and I look across and Rick's still playing, standing there like a statue, playing his guitar, and I went, that's Rick. So I go across to, and I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, hey Rick, actually you can leave the stage now, there's no more band on stage. And he went, oh. Yeah, that's Rick.
And then
Marshall was pretty loud too.
Yeah, so loud he couldn't hear that there was no band playing.
So then soon after you took on the US, that was the concert before you sort of left off and tackled the US. What was the US like for a, you know, number one Australian band at the time?
Yeah, well, it was very exciting, you know, and we had a very committed record company in Epic, and, you know, they were pulling out all the stops. We had a great agent in the William Morris agency, we felt that we'd lost our home base, because even though CBS here in Australia were fantastic with us, it wasn't the same as that whole Alberts thing with Harry Vander George Young, who weren't producing us anymore, but they were down the hall, and they were part of it. FIFA Riccobono, the team at Alberts was incredible. That's why I say, when you're in that photograph, that, you know, we had the team and we let it go. You know, it's old history, but it's a very significant part of our history. And it's very sad that we left it. My own belief, and I think Rick would back me up, is that we would have had a much bigger level of success internationally had we stayed with them, because you look at the support they gave AC/DC, they'd have done the same with us.
Looking, because I was listening to the greatest hits this morning, I was just listening to it and going, oh yeah. And one after the other comes back. And what's interesting about them is they haven't gone away. Your songs are still being played all the time.
Yeah.
for different reasons. They'll turn up in ads, they'll turn up in government things, they'll turn up, and for a whole generation who go, I don't know the Angels, and you play a couple of songs, you go, oh yeah, I do.
you don't
realise just how pervasive this music is in the Australian scene now. I mean, it's almost like, it sometimes feels like it's a bit unfair that great artists often leave this kind of mark, and it goes on for decades and decades and decades, and there's no money coming in, but the wealth of the respect and the depth of understanding of the actual art itself and the appreciation of the art itself just keeps going out and out and out and out. And it only takes I don't have to buy the album once, but I can play it how many times. I mean, these days it's a bit better because you actually see how many people are actually listening to music on Spotify and all that stuff and get more records. But you don't really have any idea just how many times some kid played your record over and over and over and over again, or on the drive to work, or listening while at work.
Yeah, I know. I remember Bob Dylan said something about that once, and I'll get it completely wrong, but he compared two art forms, music, which is exactly what you're saying, how you can sell millions of records and those people can play them millions of times, but you get something like the Mona Lisa, there's only one of them, and you've got to queue up for, a day to get to see a glimpse of it, or any painting, most of them are on the wall in someone's private gallery, and no one ever gets to see it.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I always think of music and books as very similar in that sense of being recorded. And I used to sell books, and people are always asking for the first edition. I'm going, every book's a first edition. It's exactly as the author wanted it.
Yeah.
And the same with music. Every printing of a particular bit of music is exactly as you guys wanted it, as you lay it down in the studio. So it's, in a sense, you're getting the...
Unless it's a cassette.
Yeah.
But in the Angels' case, in our case, all of that airplay that we get, the Spotify downloads and the streaming, etc., all contribute to us being a major live band, which is what we started off being and still are, and it's a huge part of our life. It's a very important part of our life to play in front of people.
Did you ever go through a period where you didn't do it and you just had to get back? Like, is there...
When Doc left the band in 2000, the whole thing got pretty hard because, we could have just said, okay, well, the Angels is over forever, but that's not what that's not how we saw it. To us, these are our songs, and we want to continue to play them through our life. And so we had to kind of reinvent ourselves for a while. Rick and me, we did the Brewster Brothers and wrote songs for me to sing.
I saw you at the Star Casino one late evening. I think I drank a bottle of champagne before I went down. I remember the first few songs. Yeah, it did help. That was wonderful.
Yeah. The thing is that...
But the songs stand up. The song.
That's what we said. We always said the songs are bigger than the band.
That's right. Yeah, John and I were talking
about Doc leaving the band is, when you come down to it, it's no different from Jim Hilburn leaving the band or anyone else. It's a member has left. The band goes on. The music goes on.
Mm. Yeah. And we've proved that. I mean, Dave Gleason's been singing in the Angels now for the last 6 years, and we're actually on a bigger level now than we were when Doc was actually in the band for one reason or another, which we won't go into. But I mean, Dave's fantastic, and the band's red hot. We played with all the stops out. The passion's still there. We're proud of our live heritage. It's always been a band that's played. Whatever we've done in front of people, and I'm kind of proud of that because you write a song, you put it on stage, and you soon know whether it's going to work or not.
Mm-hmm. What does it feel like now? Like, you get up there, you're in the concert, it's going well, and you start singing "We'll Ever See Your Face Again," and whoever's there, the thousands of people out there, to start singing back at you.
Yeah.
Like, is that something you do early so you get the feeling up, or is it something you say for the
early
end?
Early or late, it doesn't matter.
It's
like
extraordinary.
We've just been doing shows where we put that song in before the halfway mark.
Yeah.
And it's a huge point. It's a real high point because it's a high point for them in a way more than for us. Because we could say that it's our first single, wasn't successful at the time. Yeah, we have a love-hate relationship with the song. It's not a bad song, but you know, it's not our favourite song.
A lot of artists talk about that, where they're, you know, they've got this incredible, almost supernova of a song, and you know, the crowd would lynch them if they didn't play it. I think Nirvana were infamous for doing that, where Kurt wouldn't do Smells Like Teen Spirit, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever done shows where you haven't played?
Yeah, well, we didn't play Am I Gonna See Your Face Again for years, because we just went, oh, that's old hat, you know, that was our first single. The band's different to that now. That's a bit more, you know, boogie pop, you know, whatever we said at the time, I can't remember. But, you know, we were into the whole thing around Take a Long Line, Die at the One, Marseille, all that stuff, you know. And we sort of saw the song as being a little bit old hat. But my recollection, and I reckon I'm right, is we did it at Mount Isa when the first time we ever played there, which is I think 82 or 83. Hadn't played the song for at least 2 years, maybe three. And they kept on, it was like 3,500 people calling out for encores, and we just went, gee, we're running out of songs, what are we going to do? So we did Face Again, and they all did that chant.
We'd never heard it.
We'd never heard it before.
That chant that we can't mention here, of course.
Oh, we can mention it.
Yeah, but I'll mention it. They will go, no way, get fuck off. And we just went, what was that about?
are people singing it too? Like, are they at parties drunk and they're playing on the cassette and screaming it at the stereo before it even got to you guys?
You've got to remember.
Without our knowledge.
Yeah, and the thing is that, so, I mean, when it happened, it just blew us away, and we thought, oh, that's probably just something that happens in Mount Isa. But to test the waters, we put it in the show every night. We went all the way down the East Coast, we went across to Perth, we went to Adelaide. Everywhere we played, the same thing happened. So this had got round the country, and you've got to bear in mind, there was no Facebook, there's no internet, there's no mobile phones, nothing. So there's a bush telegraph, that's all there is. And this has got right round the country, massively, because everyone did it. And still do, of course.
Still do.
Whether you're 6 or 676, doesn't matter, you know. They will do it.
Because it's interesting, upstairs, there's a whole lot of millennials up there, you know, between 19 and 30. And we're trying to say, you know, the Angels come in, and they go, and then we just, all you have to do is say that, and they go, oh, right! You know, even them, like, even the, completely unplugged, completely locked into. And it still gets to them.
So people know the song even if they don't know the band.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
But look, it's an important part of what we do. You know, we do it. We don't hate doing it, and we love that the audience have a great time when it happens. And Dave does wonderful things with it and turns it around and gets him to ask the question, and then he tells them to go get fucked. It's really good, you know.
We're going to have to.
I have one final.
You got one final question? Okay, get it in there.
The influence of the Angels on huge acts like Axl Rose calls you an influence, a key influence. Slash said the same thing during the recent Soundwave festivals.
Yeah, Mike Sweedy from Pearl Jam's a huge fan.
There's a great photograph in the book of you guys up on stage with Axl Rose, and Angry, I think, was there as well at the Whiskey A Go Go.
Yeah, and Slash, and can't remember who else.
I mean, this is a far cry from the, you know, the choir singing Rick in Adelaide, or John, you know, queuing up for Beatles tickets. And
yeah, for three nights, yeah. You know, exactly, you know. The book's given us a chance to reminisce and remember all that stuff. And yeah, I mean, like, I guess it's fair to, when you talk about people like, you know, Mike McCready and Axl and Slash and stuff, I mean, they're all famous musicians. And it's great for us that, you know, our music reached those people. I believe Dave Grohl as well, who came to a show with his dad in Seattle, you know. How fantastic. But what was I going to say about that? You know, I mean, it is, in some ways, you know, it's kind of special to us that we've had some influence on them, or that they've liked what we've done. And we did pretty well in the States. I mean, Seattle is a good example. We did really well in Seattle, and that's where all those bands came from.
But we knew at that point that John mentioned, the tipping point with I Ain't the One, and we started writing those songs. At that point, we knew we had something special, that sound.
Yeah. We did, yeah. It's like, and we were in the right environment. You know, we had our own access to a wonderful studio that George and Harry gave us the key. So Rick and I'd do a gig, and we'd go around to the studio at 2 o'clock in the morning, open up with a key in King Street, park the car across the road. You can never do that now. Take the lift up there, and we spent all night.
You guys were in the studio when the Hilton bombing thing happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to have to call it quits on this one. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the thing with this book is it will start more conversations, because it's going to remind people of so many things in their past.
That's right.
That, yeah. Oh, they also did that. Oh, yeah, I remember that. And then it's one of those things that when you're reading this book, if you've been living through this era, it's going to bring out memories. It's going to underline just how important you guys were.
And we're still making the memories. Yeah. Right? That's the thing that...
That applies to younger people too, who were not around.
Yeah,
it's historical. They're going to be, that's what it was about.
Back when cool was cool.
Hear the term pub rock. What's that?
Yeah, what's a pub? Know,
read the book.
That time when we could play the Sundowner Hotel at Punch Bowl on a Monday night and put 1,500 people in a room. A Monday night.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cold Chisel would play Tuesday night, the day after we played, and they'd put 1,500 people. And it's pretty amazing, that whole pub scene back then. And we sort of created it, in a way.
Thank you very much for both coming in and talking with us about the new book.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Great. I'm shaking hands.
Me too.
I've got to say that because it's a podcast.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
The Angels is available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.